This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. 50 years ago, President Richard Nixon stepped off a plane in Beijing, a visit that changed the course of China, the U.S., the Cold War, and the world. The stories in Gish Jen's newest story collection, Thank You, Mr. Nixon, published by Knopf earlier this year, covers the 50 years since then, including stories like a Chinese woman press-ganged into translating for her Western tour group to an English professor struggling to teach the wealthy Chinese students at his university. Gish Jen is the author of one previous book of stories, 5 novels, and 2 works of nonfiction. Her honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, and the Fulbright Foundation. Her stories have been chosen for the Best American Short Stories 5 times, including the Best American Short Stories of the Century. She has also delivered the William E. Massey Senior Lectures in American Studies at Harvard University. Today, Gish and I talk about why she wrote this new story collection, covering 50 years of encounters and connections between Chinese Americans and Chinese Americans. So, Gish, you know, thank you so much for joining us on the Asian Review of Books podcast. You know, I want to start with, you know, Thank You, Mr. Nixon is being published on the 50th anniversary of Nixon's visit to China. It's the start of China's opening to the outside world. Was that deliberate? Or is that just a happy accident in terms of how the book was written?
Well, it was kind of both. So I was here in my little cabin in Vermont, sitting by a lake. It's, you know, during COVID, it's very quiet. I just finished another book, The Resistors, as you may or may not know. And I was thinking about what to do next. And, you know, the obvious thing was to do a collection of stories, because I did have a bunch of stories that I'd written over the years. All of them include, you know, involving China. And I was thinking about them, and then suddenly I realized, like, oh my God, it's the 50th anniversary of Nixon's visit to China coming up. And so that idea of sort of trying to think about capturing the 50 years in a book kind of occurred to me as I sat here by this lake. And I realized that I just had to write some more stories. The stories were already sort of interlinked to begin with. And it occurred to me that by making it 50 years that, you know, I had a whole arc, you know, very novel-like arc. A lot of people have sort of said this is kind of a novel in stories. And I think that's right, because each story has an arc, but the book as a whole also has an arc as it captures, you know, kind of what happened, you know, the great excitement of those early years, you know, the great improbability of it. And then, of course, you know, ended up on a note that's I don't think anybody could have seen back in the beginning.
Right, because, you know, as I was reading the book, you know, you see these characters, you know, the protagonist of one story will pop up in another story, even if just as a reference. But it does kind of make the collection seem, it really is this kind of grand narrative about the 50 years of China's reopening, of Chinese Americans coming to China, seeing it for
the first time ever or the first time in decades, Chinese going to America to live, to study, to work. Everything does seem to like knit together in this kind of one, in this kind of grander narrative about China.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of these things that, you know, as I was, you know, as a writer, you know, you said you weigh your project a little bit. And I like this approach, you know, partly because I already had, you know, some stories. I mean, I did have to write another 5 stories. So it's not like it was all written. I had a lot of writing to do. But it's also true that, you know, when you think about a project like trying to capture that 50 years, I mean, that is just an impossible project. And, you know, and I do it, you know, at this stage of literary history, we don't, you know, we stay away from grand narratives, right? But it's so, you know, all you can do is give a sense of what's happened. You know, you really can't capture it all. Too much has happened. I mean, it's you know, this is a huge story. But this approach allowed me to, you know, to suggest some of the things that people experienced and some of the ways in which people were affected, and most importantly, you know, to give a sense of time changing and our times changing.
So I do want to start with the very first story in the collection, which is this letter to Nixon, who is in hell, and it's very different from the other stories in the book. And so I wanted to ask, kind of, why start with that particular, I guess, style of writing? I guess why style this first story to launch this whole collection as this letter to a deceased Nixon?
Well, let me just sort of say that, you know, I use a lot of different approaches in this book. I mean, there's also a story, as you will remember, that's really based on a business case. You know, a lot of people commented on that, especially people in business. It's funny, it's a form of writing, which obviously many people are acquainted with, and but which you never, ever, ever see in literature, even though we borrow from everything, comics, movies, everything, but no one has ever borrowed from a business case before. To my knowledge. So there's a lot of different, you know, it's not like every story is a straight ahead, a realistic story, but this particular story, as you know, as you're saying, it is a letter from a girl in heaven to Richard Nixon, who is in hell. And she feels bad that he's in hell because, you know, that she sees it very differently. She sees it, as many Chinese do, as kind of this great gift that he came. And of course, she, as you know, is very smitten by Pat Nixon's red coat, as many Chinese were. And I wrote it, if it seems very different, it is true that, you know, most of the stories reflect a time that I myself lived through, or an experience that I myself, if I didn't live through it myself, that I know someone who lived through it, right? So they have some kind of tethered to reality. That particular moment in history, I do not have any particular access to, you know? So that's one of the reasons it's, you know, it's maybe a more, you know, completely imagined piece. But the other part of it is that, you know, I did sort of want to give a sense of what happened in Nixon's visit, which is not just on the, you know, not just the official history. Of course, we have lots of official history, but also, you know, how people reacted to it, you know? And like I say, you know, the fact that for this girl, you know, whatever Nixon was doing, what she remembers was that red coat. And I do think that in that moment of people's fascination with Pat Nixon, and as you know, they were fascinated, you can see the first little seed that was going to become this whole, you know, capitalist weaver that we see today. So, you know, it seemed to me to be a very important moment. And of course, it does literally lead in my book to people opening little businesses. I mean, that family goes on to have a little coat business. And as you are well aware, sitting there in Hong Kong, you know, much more happens than just a couple of coat businesses, right?
You know, it's fascinating. You know, you mentioned this seems to be based off a business case, and you're absolutely right. It does feel like it's kind of based off of these case studies of these businesses that kind of grow in China, supplying the rest of the world with these consumer products, and it's been spun out into this.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, there's an actual business case, you know, you know, the detail is that, I mean, there was, you know, a couple is actually writing a business case. And I will say that that business case that I use in that story is an actual case that I wrote with somebody else, actually for Harvard Law School. And I, you know, they didn't use it in the end, but somebody I know who, you know, who's working in China, I mean, you know, that is absolutely, you know, his description of what goes on, you know, as well, the kind of things that can go wrong if you open a little tea business or I mean, that stuff is straight from life. I mean, that is exactly what it would have been like.
So I want to start talking about kind of some of the some of the other stories you kind of talk about in your book. And I was thinking about how to kind of structure this conversation. And I kind of saw the book as vaguely fitting into two halves. And I know that's going to be overly simplistic. But at the beginning of the book, you have these stories about Chinese Americans or Chinese that moved to America because of, you know, the communist takeover, they have to leave the country, returning to China. And the two that come to mind in that particular case, there's the story about the family that goes as part of a tour group, an overseas tour group, and Opal, the Chinese mother of one of the tourists that go, has to end up translating all the time for the tourists, which is a very exhausting process for her as she is returning to China for the first time in decades. Another story that fits in this vein is the story of Duncan, who goes to teach English in the Coal Mining Institute, and kind of grappling with being a foreigner in China and some of the baggage, positive and negative, that comes with that. And so I guess if you might ask, you kind of talk about why you wanted to tell stories like that in terms of these Chinese, either Chinese, I'm going to use the word exiles, I don't quite mean it that strongly, but kind of Chinese exiles or Chinese Americans going to China for the first time in decades after its reopening.
Well, I'm telling that this is the project of the book, right? So, I mean, I'm trying to tell the story of what it was like, you know, after Nixon went to China and like what that meant for people. And of course, I myself am Chinese American. My parents are immigrants. Of course, I'm interested in the story of the very first story of all these people going back to China, where they hadn't been able to go for so many decades. My family, of course, made such a trip in 1979. Opal is not my mother, and you know, this, you know, the things in the story that happened in the story never happened to me, right? But it is true that in a general kind of way, in fact, you sort of, they're actually pointedly not on an overseas Chinese tour, right? They actually go on a, you know, kind of more mainstream tour, which Opal sort of regrets. My own family went on an overseas Chinese tour. But I remember very much, you know, I mean, I definitely wanted to capture, you know, what China looked like to people like that, as, you know, it's China is just opening and people like my family are going back. You know, in my mother's case, she's going back. People like me, second generation, are tagging along. And, you know, we are aware that our parents come from this place, but, you know, we have no idea of it really as a reality. And of course, the reality that's there is very different than the reality that, you know, people like my parents actually grew up in. And of course, I'm just interested in, you know, in the kind of the emotional truths that arise out of such a visit. So I'm trying to capture that first moment of China opening and what it was like, but also what it meant. And I do think that kind of the in-betweenness that Opal ends up with, you know, this feeling like, yeah, you know, where does she belong? You know, she's going to translate for the rest of her life. You know, I think a lot of people did come back with that kind of feeling, you know, like it sort of starts off, they're going home, except that it isn't really home, right? My mother, you know, then the trip that we went on, literally had to translate as well. It's very different than Opal's because we were on an overseas Chinese tour. But it was, you know, it's one of the things that you may appreciate from Hong Kong is that we didn't realize, I think, is that even though people all you know, quote unquote, speak Chinese. At that time, it didn't mean that they could understand each other. So there we were on an overseas Chinese tour. And my mother had warned us that, you know, we, the children of my family, would be the only ones who didn't speak Chinese. But in the end, even though everybody was a native Chinese speaker, they could not understand each other because, you know, even in Mandarin, because their Mandarin was so different one from the next, that in the end, we would go to every city and, the tour guide would say something in the local dialect. We would have a translator to Mandarin. And then my mother would translate everything from Mandarin into English. and quite ironically, yes, oh, you know, everything that happened was in English. And for various reasons, that was just not the story I wanted to tell in this particular story. But this business of just how complicated it actually was, and how, you know, how many unexpected things there were, I remember that feeling very, very well. And the next story, Duncan in China, you know, like, you know, so you see this, there's a time progression here, right? So some years later, you know, first you get this first wave of people who come on these tours, then you have a wave of people like myself, who go back to China to try to spend some time there. Again, I am not Duncan, and I did not come home with, you know, I did not fall in love with anybody while I was there the way he does. But a lot of the background definitely comes from a life. I myself did go back to teach in a coal mining institute in 1980. And certainly, you know, I do definitely use a lot of my experiences are reflected in Duncan in China. You know, it's interesting, you know, some of these things, you know, people often ask me, you know, how much of it do you make up and how much of it do you take from life? The storylines are always made up, but a lot of the background detail I do take from life. And one of the reasons is because I now see that even though I'm a fiction writer, that I kind of play an important documentary role, you know, like people who want to know, well, what was it like? You know, if I was there and I have notes, you know, it is incumbent upon me to actually use the notes and to actually, you know, convey what I actually saw. And I think it's valuable to everybody. I mean, one of the reactions, of course, you know, one writes a book like that and gets many reactions, but one of the reactions I was really happy about was the reaction of Lisa C, who was also a fiction writer, but who's also done a ton of research, you know, into China over the years. And, you know, and she said to me that she thought that she saw, you know, China represented as she had never seen, and just was really, you know, was really impressed. I was thrilled, you know, because that's part of my job too. I mean, it's obviously not my whole job, but I was happy. I was happy that I'd gotten that detail down, and I'm happy that people looking at it think, oh my God, that's just what it was like. And I'm happy that other fiction writers looking at it think, oh wow, you did a good job. So like I say, it's only one part of what I'm doing.
So I want to talk about some other stories in the collection now, and I guess these stories kind of, we're jumping forward in time now. But the two that I remember most from let's call it kind of the latter half of the collection, the stories that are more about Chinese moving to America as opposed to Chinese Americans going back to China.
It's not so much a different thing. It's you know, over what you see, the through line is time. So kind of in the beginning, so it starts in 1972, then you have these early things of people going to China. And then of course, as time goes on, more people from China start to come, right? So suddenly you have people in a law school class who just never would have been there before. So what I'm trying to capture is a sense of the whole world changing. And so it's not that I don't see it as the book falling into halves at all. I see it as, you know, as things are different. We have a different social reality. And in the new social reality, now all of it related to Nixon's visit, in the new social reality, yes, we have new people, you know, in our classrooms, you know, we have new people coming to visit, you know, so yeah, all kind, like, so I guess in one way of thinking about this book is every single one of these stories, there's something about the story that where the story could not have taken place had Nixon not gone to China. Does that make sense?
Yes, and you mentioned the classroom, and that leads into one of the stories that I remember kind of very vividly, which is the one about Rothko, the English yeah. professor who is working with. It's not quite an art forger, I think. You probably have a better way of describing what this artist tried to do.
She's definitely an art forger.
Okay.
She's not the top of the art.
It's like, isn't this a big thing in the book where it's like the English professor says, like, it's not really forgery. No one's lying to anybody. We're just choosing not to convey the full truth. Right. But that really stands because that kind of gets it. You mentioned the classroom, kind of this. The Chinese students who would go to the United States to study, out of some, I guess, because the families were seeking status or something like that. And again, like, as you note, it's a passage of time, kind of how these social relations change. As we kind of get to stories that are more connected to the, or not connected, stories that are closer to the modern day, kind of like how are you seeing those social relations, I guess, change, adapt over time from, I guess, in the decades immediately after Nixon and Mao reopened China?
Well, you know, in Rothko, you know, that story, you know, so that involves this teacher, right? And of course, one of the things about, so how could this, when I sort of say the story could never have come about had Nixon not gone to China, had Nixon not gone to China, you know, this Asian American teacher would not have all these tiny students in his class. So the whole, right, this whole premise of the story where he meets this, you know, through one of his students, he ends up involved with this art forger. None of that could have happened, right? I mean, he would never have the student in his class if Nixon had not gone. But anyway, so there he is. He's got all these tiny students. And as you know, there's a lot in the story, not just about his relationship with the student who leads to the art forger, but the students in general, you know, with all their, you know, they're trying so hard, but they come from a very different educational background. And so all the issues around imitation and plagiarism are all with us now. You know, so these are issues that, like, again, if Nixon hadn't gone to China, we would not have these students in our classrooms, and we would not have the kinds of cultural issues that they present. And so there I'm really getting at kind of like, you know, the two cultures coming into contact in this way, and, you know, with complete bafflement, you know, on both sides. So, you know, and there is a way in which this teacher, as you remember, is very sympathetic, not just to the art forger, who he sees as, you know, I mean, there's a lot of deception going on. And honestly, what she's doing is the least of it, right? I mean, what about, as you recall, you know, they refer to Rothko as being sold for millions of dollars. And that is true. I mean, a gallery in New York took, you know, that's an actual true thing, that a gallery in New York took some of these Rothko, took a Rocco knockoff, which was done by a painter. He got paid like $8,000. And she turned around and sold it for, like, you know, northward of $8 million to the chairman of Sotheby's. You know, so it's one of these things where the art forger looks like the bad guy, but, you know, it's not just the Chinese art forgers are not the only problem here. You know, it's the gallery owner is American, and, you know, I think that she's, you know, she's definitely also in problematic territory, doesn't begin to describe it, right? So you know, in this larger context, you know, the whole question also of these students who are trying so hard, but who have learned to learn through imitation, you know, and, you know, how problematic that is here in America, where we have much more individualistic ideas, where originality is everything. And, you know, an idea that is just really quite foreign to them, you know? And so when she sort of says, but I, you know, I hand in my piece and, you know, I used Turnitin.com and it said it was only, you know, 15% plagiarized. And my teacher in China said that was okay. And the guy says, no, it can't be 15% plagiarized. It must be 0% plagiarized. And, you know, and she is very genuinely confused and just not sure how to go on. And actually, she is quite genuinely in love with literature and genuinely wants to do well, has really taken quite a bold step in deciding to major in English against her parents' wishes. And she's in quite a difficult situation. And he genuinely wants to help her, but she genuinely does not know how to go forward. And, I'm interested in the predicaments all around. And like I say, you know, so to me, this is it's a kind of story that we would never have had in our classrooms or in literature, but for Nixon's having gone to China, right? So this is, I don't think we would ever see, you know, in quite so dramatically what the cultural differences are, how deep they are, and how intractable.
You know, we've constantly kind of talked about, you know, Nixon's trip to China, Nixon helping to open China, as kind of one of the motivating factors behind a lot of stories in the book. And I want to kind of have as my last kind of real question. You know, you're writing this book at a time when U.S.-China relations appear to be fraying. There are definitely fewer. It seems like there are fewer connections between ordinary Americans and ordinary Chinese people. There's obviously much less travel because of COVID. It seems like the business relations are being pulled apart to some extent. You know, how do you see kind of your book and kind of talking about these connections between Chinese Americans and Americans and the complications that come from that? How do you see kind of your book sitting in this kind of, I guess, in our current day context of decoupling, fraying relations, however you want to describe it?
Well, you know, I hope that my book supplies some perspective. You know, so I hope that people can remember, you know, just how much has happened in 50 years. And I hope that they give people hope. I mean, I think that obviously things are at a terrible point right now, but things change. China changes fast. And America changes also, sometimes also fast, sometimes not in the right direction, but in any case. So I just hope that, you know, people can remember what this journey has been and also be aware that, you know, we're kind of at a little pausing spot now, or 50 years, but there are 50 more years after this 50 years. And as much as it's changed in this first 50 years, we can change again in the next 50. So, so all is not lost in my view. And I hope that also, though, you know, in my book, I think that you do get some sense of how many people's lives are changed by all of this. And I do think that, you know, for anybody involved in U.S.-China relations, I'm sure they're aware of just how much it means to people's lives. I hope that that comes across in this book. And for all that I just sort of said, all this about cultural difference, what I think you can see too over the course of the book are definitely two cultures that are definitely coming closer together. Like I say, it's bumpy, very bumpy. But they are coming closer together, and many wonderful things are coming out of that as well.
So with that, I think that ends our interview with Gish Jen, author of Thank You, Mr. Nixon. So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. There will be podcasts on favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for who's coming up next on the show. But before then, thank you so much, Gish, for joining us today.
My pleasure, Nick.